And welcome back, everybody. We are talking with Kai Murros, joining us from Finland. This is the second segment. We have much more to discuss here. I wanted to get a little bit closer to, I guess, some of the hopelessness that people might feel at this time, as we're seeing our own countries being, you know, lost really in front of our eyes. Our culture is being eroded, our heritage. We're getting, you know, flooded with immigration. And if the current projection trends are true, when it comes to birth rates and everything else, we're talking about replacement level migrations. In some cases, we have immigrants having a lot of children as opposed to Europeans have a very few. And two, three generations from now, we might see a complete change in the demographics. Our resources are getting depleted. The government in these countries are completely kind of giving up on us as well on top of it. It's, of course, reason to feel a lot of hopelessness in that situation, Kai, but maybe you can tell us a bit more about how you've managed to stay positive in that regard, in terms of how we can manage to preserve our cultures. When we see the news unfolding in front of our eyes, how do you decode that? How do you interpret that? And how do you not stay pessimistic about what's happening?
Well, yeah, I have to tell you that in my younger days, I often was quite angry, and I had these spells of pessimism, but then, by the time I was writing my book about the revolution, it was it spring 1999, yeah. And I sort of, when I sat down and thought, okay, how do things actually go, and started writing my book and made sort of try to make these things absolutely clear to me. And ever since that time, spring 99, I've been just enjoying the ride, because it sort of came very clear to me that this will end only one way, and we are going to be on top. I mean, we are not going to disappear. Because the economic system is eating its way, and once the economy collapses, the whole structure comes down, and once there is money and all what is today important, once it becomes totally like loses its value, all there is left is the people and the land. And so I'm just enjoying the ride. There's nothing so would shake my conviction that things are going to end very well for us. I've had this mood since 99.
All right, interesting. Now, how do you view, let's say, collectivism or socialism? Some people say that European tradition, or Western tradition in particular, is kind of slated more towards individualism, and this has created, to a certain extent, the uniqueness of Western civilization. That's even what has led to the fact that we've been countries that have been able to, let's say, take in other people from other parts of the world. We've had, you know, focus on human rights, etc., and all these kinds of issues, but at the same time, some of the weakness there in individualism has to, or lack to, let's say, organize or get together on the same level, perhaps, as some of the other cultures out there. How do you view that situation in terms of individualism versus collectivism or even socialism, if you will?
Yeah, it's very difficult to say that is our culture really individualistic or collectivistic, because it depends on who you are, how you want to perceive these things. There are no sort of clear-cut solutions or answers. What are we? Is this individualistic or collectivistic culture? Because it depends on from where you are looking at things. So I think European civilization in this respect, like any other civilization, is sort of both and individualistic and collectivistic. But anyway, whatever it is, eventually it has been enormously powerful, enormously effective. For me, I was reading in the 90s the Max Weber and his books about European capitalism, all that, and it's sort of he compared Europe to other civilizations and sort of made clear why Europeans are so effective. And so I said to myself, this is not going away, it's still here, and this is our competitive edge, and once the day comes when we use this to the fullest, then we'll be just on top of the global food chain.
Now, how do you, I guess, appeal to people if we look at it from a kind of a strategy point of view, from the message that you bring, Kai, in terms of You know, ultimately, I guess it's a numbers game. This is something that you have to gain, you know, popularity to a certain extent. You have to sell it to the masses.
Yeah.
How is that done?
Well, I've been toying with the idea quite a lot, and they've of course tried all sorts of experiments. Well, in my head, basically, that would this sell, or how would that do, and all that. I personally find this selling much more appealing than the sort of theory. I sort of like to be some sort of work in the commercial business, maybe copywriter or something, because it's very important that we have to sell this ideology and this idea to people. I mean, some gloomy intellectuals in library writing stuffy books one after another, it just won't help us get anywhere.
Right.
But then how will this be sold to the people? Well, it's one of those things that luckily I don't have to find the answer, because it's happening. It's sort of unfolding itself, this problem, because once there's a pressure to some, we've been cornered and now we are fighting for our survival. So people just start inventing stuff, and they just start inventing this story and how to tell it to other people. So it would be very nice to somehow be able to take part in this process now it comes. What I want, that my greatest dream has been 60, 70 years, that we could could take part in the how to create the concept of pan-European nationalism, the concept, how it looks, how it sounds, the music, the uniforms, the ideology, everything, you know, and you should be able to condense it into one book. And the whole concept, what's it about? And once we get that concept good, well, and nice looking, and all the aspects are there, how to build a society, etc., etc., then it's going to sell. It's going to be a massive thing. But you know, we are still working on that concept. But it doesn't take much. Once you get it, then you get it. And once you get it, there's no going back there's no going back anymore. Then you have it, and that's going to change the whole game.
Now, one thing I think that is working kind of for itself at a certain degree is that whatever is happening in the world right now, the elite, the global establishment, the way that the world is turning and everything else, and the way that they've directed our current civilization, it's turned decadent. It's falling apart. It's kind of turning into some kind of Sodom and Gomorrah type civilization, yeah. Almost, right? And people within that, people are going to obviously start looking elsewhere to seek structures, to seek strength, to seek something. I guess what I'm saying is it's been a fad with the type of revolution or subversive activities that we've seen. And the question is then, okay, what kind of environment has that created? Well, it's created what we see today in front of our eyes. And I think that people inherently are going to get increasingly tired and fed up with that. And they want to do something which is different, maybe even a revival of traditionalism, maybe even a revival where it becomes fashionable or popular to have a strong core family unit again, for example, right? There's certain inherent things in nature within our biology that is going to be appealing to people, correct?
Yes. This is going to be, of course, we cannot have a revolution unless we have a cultural revolution. And it's going to be sort of a revolution of style. It's sort of about our appearance, how we carry ourselves, how we behave, how we talk, and from that it comes from our clothes to our buildings, and from to cars and everything we manufacture and create. It sort of reflects this new reality that we will be living in, and so it's like great epochs in history, they always have their own style, and that is something that we will have also. And once we have that style, it will be then the masses will just love it and sort of adopt that style. And we have this, it's already coming, like traditionalism is coming back, but the thing is that it's going to be, of course, sort of in a modern way. We have we have heavy metal music, we have power metal, which is basically the sort of European paganism and pan-Europeanism in a modern version. And I especially, I never play these computer games, but I love them because you have all these, they are just fighting. Young men learn to how to, you know, kill the enemy. But then you have like Civilization and these other games where you learn to create empires. And the best thing is that when you have these games, there are always these quotations from, you know, from great leaders of the past, and they are not from Martin Luther King or Mahatma Gandhi. They are like Hitler and Napoleon and Hannibal and all these great leaders, cynical tyrants and murderers. And when you learn history from them, it's totally different from what you learn from these leftist women. And there's the hope. And you have like movies like The Lord of the Rings, which is sort which is National Socialist propaganda at its best.
Interesting. Yeah, because I was thinking about that too, in terms of, you know, storytelling, and that it's, despite, you know, some epic movies have been done on Tolkien's work and things like that. So, you know, Beowulf has been done. There's a couple of them, but it's really just a handful of movies, really, that goes to the heart of European storytelling. And Hollywood, to a large extent, of course, have excluded a lot of the tremendous, you know, stories that we have in European culture and whatnot. How important do you think it is to take over the storytelling when it comes to spreading our role models of our heroes, of, because this is something that we're not seeing from Hollywood, really. We need our own, you know, film industry, music industry, to a certain extent, pop culture, if you will, but from a perspective of preservation of European culture. Wouldn't you agree?
Yes, it's absolutely vital. We have to create our own myths. I mean, all nations, all cultures, all civilizations, they are based on some sort of myth. The myth that brings people together. Religions are myths, and so we need to create our own myths that then will bind people together, and we will do that. And this battle will be won by those who create the best rhetoric. Which sort of word is so essential? It's the key to people's hearts. And once you create speeches and concepts and words that go into the people's minds and hearts, then you win this struggle. And all great speeches in world history have been usually given before battles or when something really important happens. So we need to have our great orators, we need to have our great speeches, we need to have our own, the quotations that will live for centuries, and everybody will remember this was said right when Europe was facing death and destruction. So we need all those things, and we need to tell this story. This has to be a story. We have to see ourselves as we are heroes in a story, and that will empower us, because then we see ourselves as part of this greater story, this sort of greater context. And that's why stories are so immensely important, because they condense the message into few words, and we have to see ourselves as players in those great stories.
If we look at education and academia and other things like that, it's clear that there's been a kind of a self-hatred imposed upon us. We've definitely learned to hate ourselves, and I can just kind of chime in on that, I guess, in terms of how it is or was growing up in Sweden and in that type of environment. It was a very, in many cases, it was just kind of a neglect, I guess, of our own history and culture. They didn't really talk about a lot of those things, and we didn't really get to learn about our past and the you know, the proud warrior cultures that we had from, you know, Germanic all the way up to the, you know, the Great Northern Wars and whatnot. But my point is, we've learned to hate ourselves. But what I heard you said is that now we need to learn to love ourselves, right? We need to understand that we have greatness within us, and it's part of our makeup. How do we turn that tide? Okay.
You know, we must, you know, young people today, they need a healthy dose of narcissism. You know, white kids can stand before a mirror and say that I look great. You know, white is beautiful. And that's why I would like to, you know, create sort of naturalist white fashion, so which would make people look great, even without, you don't need, you know, swastikas everywhere. It's just cool looking clothes, you know, suits and leather jackets and all that. And when people wear them, they know that they not only do they look good, but they also represent sort of healthy, arrogant values. Arrogance is a very important word. We have to teach our young children, young people, to be arrogant. Extremely arrogant, you know, just behave like they were aristocrats, because they are.
Yeah, because today children are, you know, they're, we've seen the movie, we've talked about it here on the program before, you know, there are conferences now on white privilege, and it's encouraged that people wear, you know, white wristbands to remind themselves of who they are, and it's a tremendous kind of very racist anti-white attitudes that we've seen sprung up in the world in recent times. And I think it's horrible to see that children on any side of the fence, wherever, are being told to resent themselves either on the basis of historical truth or especially on historical lies. But nonetheless, this is what's happening in many, you know, educational environments. And it's just horrible of children who had nothing to do, even if we take, again, the official lies that we hear from the academic world about, let's say, colonialism or even slavery or what have you. These children have had nothing to do with it, and yet they have become the victims of this. They become the objects of those they have to turn around. And I think it's quite evident at that stage that they are definitely seeking to undermine these children for some reason, and they're told to hate themselves, right?
Yes. And once again, you mentioned the key word, which is the worst enemy. That's academia. Yeah. Universities. Yeah. And I mean, I remember when I was in the 70s, I was about 10, and in Finland there was this particularly virulent, nasty communist youth who took over basically the whole university system and also art and everything. And they were always so much talk in the radio and TV, always talking about intellectuals, this intellectuals, that. And I remember that for some reason, whenever I heard what these intellectuals were saying or doing, I got so mad, so angry. I was wondering what's wrong with intellectuals. But then I heard, I read an article that in Cambodia, the Khmer Rouge, they're actually killing people who had spectacles because they were considered to be intellectuals. And then I read that in China, they're actually sending intellectuals to, you know, do hard labor in the countryside. And I started thinking, my God, I'm not the only one who has noticed that there's something wrong with the intellectuals. And the funny thing is that even though I was like rabid anti-communist, I started supporting the Maoists and the Khmer Rouge, and I think that actually they were actually the good guys. And today I see it this way, that okay, we may try to engage in some kind of debate in the universities, blah blah blah, but basically universities are a lost cause. So that's why we need a masses of nationalist Khmer Noir, you know, dark Khmers, sort of, they had these, you know, scarves over their faces and black hoodies and hope, preferably from the working class. And let's just, you know, level the universities. I mean, if you can't debate them, you know, win them in a debate, but actually just wipe out the whole fucking system. We don't need those universities. So we need, we need is a sort of nationalist cultural revolution. And what I want to see one day is like hundreds and hundreds of thousands, absolutely fanatical kids, you know, like in China, you know, going absolutely and totally and utterly berserk and just, you know, beating up those professors and throwing them out of the windows and burning books and so that you know, no leftist can even go to near universities because they know what will happen. And so even though, you know, Mao Zedong has had some bad press over the last decades, but you know, when I see those, you know, films when he's like walking in, you know, in China, you have these huge masses of young people cheering him, I feel that it was a good thing. You know, you just need to wipe out all that all old, which if it's against your people, and we should learn to, we should sort of learn to think that we, in the end, we have to treat the whole academic world with the same ferocity as the Maoists and the Khmer Rouge did in back then in the 70s. It's absolutely vital. We do not engage in any debate with those people. We just, you know, wipe them out once and for all.
Yeah, so you're viewing these as traitors. These are the highest of criminals, really, in your view, right?
They are. Yeah, they are. Yeah, mm-hmm. Indeed. And then afterwards, we can create a new system. But at the moment, we need a nationalist cultural revolution, which is exactly as ruthless and brutal and violent as it was in Cambodia or in China. We have to learn from those guys. I mean, I was in China for 1 year trying to learn language. Well, I'm not very good in learning languages, so too bad I didn't quite learn it. But anyway, I enjoyed it. And so I think Pol Pot and Mao Zedong, they can teach us quite a lot.
Interesting. So there's no way to take over and turn around the university environment, in your view? It just needs to be purged.
It has to be purged. I mean, it's a waste of time having debates with lesbian, you know, professors of lesbian studies. I mean, what's the point? Just throw them out of the window.
Now, so let me ask you about, I guess strength and confidence, because I've heard you previously talk about as well. And I guess that's kind of a split limit in your message from what I'm perceiving, that in terms of attracting people to, the message that you're talking about, it just have to be, you kind of have to lead by example, right? You have to be there as confidence and strength, and that this will attract people to it. It's, as we talked about before, it's kind of nothing. I'm not saying that nothing needs to be done, but I'm saying the hard work is really done by the opposition itself in terms of how they're running the world and how it's running it into the ground. And at that point, whenever that breaking point will be, and that will be different at different times for different people, but whenever they come along to seek something else, some kind of, let's say, stability, they're seeking something, a resurgent of let's say, their tradition, or they want to go back to their culture, they want to find their roots again, what have you, then there needs to be something in place already where those people can come to. And that's a really important, kind of timing essence of this in terms of what you're talking about as well. Is that there, or does that need to be, created to a certain extent? Or are you talking about creating, let's say, organizations and groups and, getting together? Or how would you see that play out, Kai?
Yes, of course, we need organizations. We need sort of movements and all that. But the cultural aspect, it's taking place as we speak. I mean, it's being created every day, and it's growing, and it's become more sort of versatile. So we are already in the situation of that the cultural revolution or the counterculture is being created constantly thanks to internet. But the process is going on at this very moment. So we don't have to be afraid that if anything is done, of course, it's going on as we speak.
What do you think the responses to this will be? We've talked before on this program about, obviously censorship of the internet and certain things, that this has worked, against them to that extent that it's very, dangerous when people get together and talk and agree on certain things for them. And the establishment and the globalists and everything else. Is there any danger of them trying to censor this in any regard, as you see it?
Yes, of course, they try to censor it. And actually, I have nothing against that. I mean, the more they try to censor it, the more clever we have to become. And the more they try to censor it, the more it tells us about their weakness.
So all of this is really kind of harnessing and reawakening the European spirit. Do you think that there is a bigger cycle at play here? We had a previous guest with us. He came from a Catholic perspective, E. Michael Jones, and he said something very interesting on this program. He talked about how Islam had arrived at the gates of Europe every time that we kind of lost our way. It was there as a kind of a reminder to us of that we don't lose focus, that we don't lose our place. And I, to a certain extent, I see what he's getting at, that when we've gone astray, something occurs that is attempting to kind of reawaken us. Would you agree with that?
Yes, definitely. Yeah.
So but the only difference, I guess, this time is that we've let it happen to ourselves. We've let in. I know many people don't see it this way, but I think it's fairly naive to think that cultures that have been fighting for thousands of years, Islam and European Western civilization, to all of a sudden just begin to blend these on the same geography and expect that everything is going to be okay and that there's not going to be any consequences of this. That's tremendously naive. Do you think that it's primarily because people do not longer they don't understand or read any history, so they don't have this perspective, perhaps?
yeah, people don't have, usually people don't have perspective. And then when people are taught history, it's just, you know, about slavery and all that kind of stuff. So, but in the old days, the history that was taught to people, it was pretty much different. And so they would not have accepted what is going on at the moment. But yeah, that's true. Yeah.
So greatness of our culture, the good achievements that we've made, is very important to kind of bring into the equation as well, and begin to teaching, you know, kids about all the good stuff that has been brought about. To, well, I mean, if we were to be objective and honest about this, look at the tremendous advancements that have come from Western civilization, right? Even this very aspect that people sit around and complain on it while they're using, you know, Twitter and the internet, and these things wouldn't even be around if it wasn't for, you know, Western civilization, right?
Exactly. We have to teach young people that not only are we good, we are better than others. And that's the whole key.
So what do you think about another point I wanted to address with you about? How do you view, let's say, our paganism, pagan roots, and the idea of Christianity's role in Western culture and civilization as well? We've certainly viewed a lot on, you know, ancient northern traditional cultures and where they stem from, and that we've had many, many thousands of years of a you know, more northern European religious, you know, ideology. And all of a sudden, this invader really came around, and with great force in some cases, very violently, that was imposed upon us, and we were forcibly conversed to Christianity. And I believe that a lot of people that did not want to go along with this were actually, they were slaughtered, they were taken out, and a lot of the brave people who would offer the resistance to this is no longer with us. How do you view Christianity and its role with Europe?
Yeah, well, I would say this is a huge, a massive sort of topic: Christianity versus paganism. Which was good? Was it bad? Etc. But I would say that, given the European history during the past 17 centuries, I mean, it is totally and utterly impossible to even imagine Europe without Christianity. I'm personally atheist, so I have nothing invested interest in this. But you cannot imagine European history and Europe and Europe's achievements without the element of Christianity in Europe. And so that's why, whether Christianity was a bad thing or a good thing for Europe, I don't know. But nevertheless, it has been there since the very moment, and it's been part of this extremely aggressive and dynamic culture. And many of the problems that we have today are exactly because of Christianity. So as sort of Christianity is sort of a double-edged sword, which in certain times, in certain places, in certain events has been actually, I would imagine, I would say actually quite a very positive force. But then it has sort of turned into what it is today, and sort of become a instrument of self-destruction. Obviously, the Christianity spreading across the Europe, it was a brutal business, and wiping out paganism was in many ways a terrible thing. But still, Europe is what it is, and Christianity is part of this thing, and therefore, I wouldn't right away say that it was only a bad thing that Christianity spread into Europe, because, well, like state formation, all that is sort of Europe. It was sort of a creation of the Catholic Church, because you have the Catholic Church sending emissaries to, you know, these tribal kings, and suddenly you have monasteries, you have towns, you have written language and civil service, all that. So it's like, this is such a huge topic. But I would say that I understand pagans. I understand them very well. But then again, we just have to understand that Christianity has always played a huge part in the development of Europe.
And it's also, you know, ironically then led us to a kind of a path towards centralization, correct? Because I mean, if we look at, I mean, Sweden example, how that was formed as a nation state, that's fairly recently. I mean, we had territories, kingdoms, chieftains. We had, you know, the Goths fighting the Swedes more to the north, and the, you know, the Danes, they were very tribal and divided in that way. So
exactly, So the Swedes are sort of bunch of very wild Vikings, but then the Pope in Rome decides that we have to do something about it. So they start converting Swedes into Christianity, and suddenly you have a monastery, and you have people who can read and write, and suddenly you have a civil service, all that. There's the whole structure of the state is basically created by Christianity and the Christian Church, Catholic Church.
And is that a positive in your view?
Yes, of course, because that's what we are. We are powerful, effective nation states that have conquered the entire planet. So it's just like the wars that Europeans fought against each other. Even those wars were actually a positive thing because they forced Europeans to become more and more sort of effective. The state had to become more effective. The weapons we designed, they had to be more effective. So it was sort of a brutal, relentless school that made Europeans so ferocious when they then finally spread across the planet.
Well, this is something that we see in nature, right? I mean, this is something we have the predator and the prey relationship, etc. We've had some extraordinary expressions in nature arise due to this kind of relationship. Struggle is basically everything, and I think that people have a negative view on it today. We have people that view, you know, when the lion takes the gazelle or something, which is, it's horrible, and if we could do something about it, we would go in there and stop it, right? We would give the lion soy protein instead if we could.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's kind of it's almost like we've been weakened to the beautiful cycle of life, and within that, a kind of a mental disease almost have set in, where we're so disconnected from nature that we refuse to acknowledge the rules within it. Correct?
That's true. Yeah. That's thank you to social democracy and all that.
Exactly. Now, a few more points here before we begin to wrap things up here for this time. But is your view that we are overpopulated on the planet? I mean, just from an environmental perspective alone, there is a reason to be pessimistic about immigration to certain areas that are already struggling with a diminishing, forest and the expansion of, you know, suburban areas and cityscapes and everything else. Are we overpopulated?
Yes, I mean, you asked about that sort of cycles. I remember that, long cycles. And one of the huge cycle is the historical cycle is the spread of Western medicine into third world. This is sort of a very important thing, that the spread of Western medicine into the third world and the ensuing massive population growth. And this is one of the things that will ignite our future, because it's going to be a relentless war over natural resources and against invading masses, because the population will grow immensely in the future. And one of those things that sort of force us in the corner, which is, of course, is a good thing. But but this is something that started already, like in the 17th century, when the population started to grow in Europe, and we managed to conquer large parts of the world because we actually were a very populous race back then. But now things have changed. Now our population is diminishing, but the population in the third world is growing because of the fruits of our labor and now our science is now helping them to grow. And now this huge population sort of pressure that used to originally started in Europe has now sort of reversed, and the pressure is towards Europe by these ever swelling masses of, you know, what are Arabs and Africans. So this is actually a huge sort of demographic transition, and it cannot be its impact cannot be underestimated. When Europeans were growing, they conquered the planet, and now they are growing. So we either be conquered or we fight back and survive.
So this is to a large extent also fight over territory and resources, right?
Yes, this is fight over territory. This is a struggle over natural resources, not only what we have in Europe, but of course one of the reasons why Europeans have to stick together is that we have to make sure that those natural resources that are not within our reach in Europe but outside Europe we can sort of exploit them. I mean, we are going to have to fight with the Chinese over Africa. I mean, that's for sure. There's going to be a new scramble for Africa. It's going on as we speak.
Sure.
And
yeah.
The only difference is now that is China going to get the natural resources of Africa or us? I mean, the Africans themselves are totally and utterly unable to use them ever. But it's going to be either the Chinese or us.
So ultimately, this is about survival in your view, and this is just something that is part of, I guess, of the natural makeup of human beings. There's no, in your view, like a rationality that is going to be able to stop this, both expansion, but also just the desire of will to take over territory, to take resources, etc. There's no way of kind of stopping what you see as a coming war, correct?
Yes, absolutely.
Interesting. So we are obviously explorers and inventors as well. You said in one of your videos that, you know, we've reached the moon, we've split the atom and whatnot. You know, we've gone to extraordinary lengths here. What is the prospect of getting out into space, of continuing a space program, of going places perhaps where there is more room, where there is more resources? Is that something that is viable in your view? Is that just a pipe dream?
No, it's not a pipe dream. It's that, I mean, we always go forward. That's what we do. And eventually, once we have, you know, settled the score on Earth, the next thing to do is we explore the space. I mean, it's in us. It's our part of our genetic makeup. It's what makes our race what it is. Of course, we go to Moon, and then we go to Mars, and always forward, never stopping, never going backwards, always forward. That's us.
Very good. Now, very good. Let's talk a little bit more. I wanted to ask you if there's anything else you think that audience should know about when it comes to the rise of a kind of a pan-European nationalist movement. I don't know if there's any components to this yet that we haven't talked about. Is there anything you'd like to kind of leave us with here, Kai, as we begin to wrap things up for this time?
Well, I don't know. I've been talking so much that I think I've pretty much said everything. Or then I remember it, but it will be too late.
All right. Okay. Well, maybe we can have you back again. We can continue talking about this and whatnot. It's always interesting to hear about, you know, what you have to say and everything else. But we're going to have some of the links up here to your website where people can find your writing and your videos. Are you continuing to make videos regularly on your YouTube channel as well, Kai?
Well, whenever I've managed to create and make a video, I always decide that this was the last one. Because first of all, I mean, I write stuff extremely slowly because I write it in English. And so it takes so much time and it's so excruciating. So I always decide, well, this was the last piece. No, I won't write anything anymore. But, we'll have to see. But I'm not promising anything. Most likely, I will not produce anything anymore, but you never know.
All right. Well, is there any other reason for that, or is it just are you feeling you're tapped out, so much to talk about? I mean, right? You should be out there and talking.
I think that many times I feel that, well, basically I've said everything that I had to say. That I'm afraid that I just keep sort of repeating myself,
right.
And especially when I write English, and I always think that I try to find some sort of great metaphors and juicy sentences and but because my vocabulary is fairly limited, so it takes time, and so I noticed that sometimes I already sort of borrow from stuff from my older speeches, so I can't have that. So maybe at a certain point I just, you know, shut up and I've done my bit.
All right. Well, it's very interesting things you have to say, and it's very. You know, very, very interesting. Now, I guess the YouTube channel, we can just mention it quickly, is youtube.com/ Kai Murrows, and it's KAIMURROS. You can just Google that as well, Kai Murrows, and you'll get a number of hits and find the book Revolution and How to Do It in a Modern Society as well. Thank you so much for your time today, Kai. Really appreciate it. Keep up the good work, and maybe we can do it again in the future.
Okay. Bye-bye.
And okay, as we begin to wrap up here for today, I just want to mention that we have more upcoming with Kevin MacDonald, Dennis Fetcho, John Rappaport, Michael Hoffman, John DeNugent, Veronica Clark, Susan Lindauer, and Tracy Twyman. I hope you have a great rest of your day or evening wherever you are. Thank you for listening, and thank you for your membership. We'll be back in just a few days as we continue our inquiries and as we put focus on the important issues ahead. Take good care. We'll talk to you later.